Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where David Coleman makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. He's very well known to us all, but formerly the Minister for Immigration, Citizenship, Migrant Services and Multicultural Affairs. It's a very busy portfolio, and we're honoured to have the Minister here tonight. Very briefly, background in law and arts from UNSW, member for then into an extended period in business, and then the member for banks since 2013, and the current position since the last election. So welcome to Minister Coleman talking on the topic of sovereign, focused and fair immigration policy under the Morrison government. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jared. I want to start out by, of course, acknowledging the very serious events that have taken place here in Sydney this afternoon. My thoughts are, of course, with the victims and all of those caught up in this appalling event. I would also echo the comments of the New South Wales Police and the Prime Minister in commending those who were first on the scene. The incident, of course, will be fully investigated by the police, and so I won't be making any further comments on it this evening. I want to thank the Sydney Institute for having me here tonight. The Institute, as you know, has a long and distinguished history of advancing the national debate in Australia. And so often, at the centre of that debate is the question of the proper role of government. What is it here to achieve? For me, the overarching purpose of government must be to build the foundations on which a nation can succeed. And over the course of our history, it's fair to say that Australian governments have generally succeeded in achieving that goal. After all, people the world over aspire to live here. So what do we get right? What made us strong? It's self-evident that our commitment to democracy trumps all other factors in our success. Democracy gives voice to our best instincts and restrains our worst ones. And of course, a close second is our economic freedom, which enables us to pursue the dreams that democracy enlivens. We must always defend our democratic and economic freedoms. But what comes next? If you look back at our history, it's hard to escape the conclusion that immigration has been absolutely fundamental to our success. Today, almost half of us were either born overseas or have a parent who was born overseas. Since the Second World War, in particular, we've welcomed people from all corners of the globe. Immigration has grown our economy, broadened our horizons, and reduced the impact of our geographic isolation. It's created the platform on which millions of Australians have built their lives. People who have worked hard, played by the rules, and helped to build a stronger Australia. People who have made immense sacrifices so that their kids can aspire to be anything. But immigration is a complex policy area, and it must always be approached with clear eyes and clarity of thought. The government's approach to immigration can be summarised in three words: sovereign, focused, and fair. Now, nobody would seriously suggest that Australia should not control its own economic policy. And nobody would say that we shouldn't control our own health or education policy. The same principle must always apply to immigration. As a nation, we must determine our policies and then implement them. It's our job to do this, nobody else's. When sovereignty over our immigration program is lost, public confidence is lost too. Australians accept that there are different views within our nation on immigration, and they accept that their personal view might not always be reflected by the government of the day. But what they cannot accept, and never should be asked to accept, is that someone other than the government of Australia will decide the outcomes of Australia's migration program. This fundamental principle underlines everything we do in immigration. A sovereign system creates the framework in which we can make decisions in Australia's national interest. Without a sovereign system, our national interest is subverted by others. If you look at Australia's post-war public policy history, it's hard to find a worse failure than the loss of control of our borders between 2007 and 2013. It was a humanitarian catastrophe. The numbers are staggering to recall. 50,000 people arrived on more than 800 boats, 8,000 children were forcibly placed in detention, and 1,200 people tragically drowned at sea. And the arrival of people on boats directly disadvantaged people who would otherwise have found humanitarian support in Australia. The Special Humanitarian Program, a key part of our annual migration program, was decimated during this period, with approximately a 90% fall in numbers. Instead of about 5,000 people per year being allowed into Australia under this program, the number dropped to about 500. This occurred because the available places were taken by people who had arrived on boats. Special humanitarian entrants face some of the world's most dire situations, and it is right that we seek to help them. But when the previous government lost control of our borders, they also lost control of the capacity to help this most vulnerable group. Under the Prime Minister and Peter Dutton, sovereign borders were, of course, restored. The 2,000 children in detention in July 2013 were all released. 19 detention centres were closed, saving taxpayers $500 million. And the overall population in detention in Australia has fallen by close to 90%, from more than 10,000 in July 2013 to about 1,300 today. You'll recall that none of this was easy, and that it was said that it couldn't be done. But it was done, and it had to be done. Australians are big-hearted, and we want to support, we want to help people fleeing awful situations. But we know that unless we control the manner in which that is done, the system falls apart. That is not acceptable to Australians, and nor should it be. An important part of asserting our sovereignty is ensuring that people who are guests in Australia respect the laws of Australia. In 2014, our government strengthened the character test under the Migration Act to cancel or deny visas to people convicted to a criminal sentence of 12 months or more. This has led to more than 4,700 people having their visas cancelled over the past 6 years, an increase of more than seven times over the previous government. Recently, I introduced a bill to Parliament which will further strengthen these character rules. The crimes involved are serious. Violent offences, sexual offences, firearms offences, and breaches of apprehended violence orders. If non-citizens have been convicted of these serious crimes, then our government's view is clear. They should fail the character test. With our sovereign position secure, we are free to make choices across our immigration program, choices that reflect our priorities. So, what are those decisions? We often talk about the immigration program as if it is just one thing, but it is actually a wide range of different programs. We need to make explicit choices in our national interest in all of them. The first key point is that in recent years, we've reduced our annual permanent migration intake. Population pressure in Sydney and Melbourne in particular has been very substantial, with growth of 18 and 25% respectively between 2006 and 2016. This has led to real and legitimate concerns about congestion in our major cities. In March, we announced that the cap on the annual migration intake will be reduced from 190,000 to 160,000 for the 2019-20 year. And we've also announced a range of measures that will encourage migrants to settle in regional Australia, further reducing the population pressure on Sydney and Melbourne. Within our annual migration program, skilled migration is a linchpin of our approach, accounting for close to 70% of the intake. Skilled migrants add value to Australian businesses. They generate significant tax revenue. They start their own companies. They create the conditions that lead to more Australian job opportunities. And it stands to reason that the more skilled a migrant is, the better. When you strip out the ups and downs of the economic cycle, productivity is the thing that really matters. When we get more out of our inputs, whatever they are, we create the wealth that leads to sustainable increases in living standards. When we talk about productivity growth, we usually talk about improving output in existing roles and industries. There's an implicit assumption in much of the productivity discussion that the key task is to be better at what we do today. And that's important, of course. Getting more out of the status quo is essential to making the status quo better. But productivity growth isn't just about getting more out of existing inputs. It's also about shifting the mix of what we do to higher value activities. When immigration helps us to increase our strength in high value sectors, it increases our overall productivity and national income. I saw examples of this when I was chairman of 9MSN, the joint venture between Nine and Microsoft. We would often have Microsoft executives move to Australia from the US to work in our offices. And those executives would frequently propose that we do new things in the business to help make it grow. Their expertise led to the launch of new products and services and the employment of more Australians, typically in software development, as a direct result. Immigration, in that example, was acting as a direct catalyst for the creation of high-wage, highly productive Australian jobs. When the immigration system fills gaps in high-value sectors, it helps to prod the economy in the direction of more productivity and more wealth. This is unquestionably a good thing. Last week, I announced that the government will be making permanent the new Global Talent Employer-sponsored program. Where labour market testing establishes that no local employee is available, the Global Talent Program makes it easier for startups and established companies to access the highly skilled people they need. The fact is that high-tech jobs don't always fit neatly into a bureaucratic analysis of the labour market, and that startups often have needs that no top-down template could have foreseen. Since the trial began late last year, we've reached agreements with numerous startups and established companies, including Canva and Cochlear. These agreements will make it easier for those companies to grow their business in a way that generates more employment for Australians. This year, we're also launching the Global Talent Independent Program, a key part of our immigration strategy. It has an ambitious goal. That goal is to identify and proactively recruit up to 5,000 highly skilled migrants per year. Under the Global Talent Program, we will seek out the very best people in high growth industries and encourage them to come to Australia to help grow those industries. Home Affairs staff will be placed on the ground in key overseas locations with the task of recruiting very high value migrants. Last month, an officer commenced work in Berlin. And next month, we'll be placing staff in Washington, Singapore, Shanghai, Santiago, and Dubai. this direct overseas recruitment effort is the first of its kind in our immigration program. Our overseas teams will work with the world's top universities, professional associations, and other institutions to market the global talent program to exceptional candidates. By attracting the very best, we will help to build enterprises that will employ large numbers of Australians in high-skill, high-wage jobs. Over time, the Global Talent Initiative has the potential to have a transformational impact on the Australian economy. Another important part of our skilled immigration system is our investment-related visas. Now, there are several of these visas, and last year, about 7,000 people came to Australia under these programs. These visas are premised on the idea that investment in the Australian economy is a positive thing, and that people who want to provide job-creating capital should be encouraged to do so. It makes sense. But as with all ideas, we need to sharply focus on the practical execution to ensure that we are fully delivering on the goal. To that end, I'll be reviewing our business investment visas with a simple question in mind. Can we get a better deal for Australia? Immigration to Australia is highly attractive to this cohort, and we need to ensure that we maximise the returns to our economy from their investment. Focus is also about ensuring that our immigration processes are run as efficiently as possible. In March, I announced a significant expansion of the Accredited Sponsors Program. Under the Accredited Sponsors Program, approved businesses are able to have skilled visa applications processed more quickly. This program is only available to well-established businesses with an unblemished record with their involvement in immigration applications. The expansion of the Accredited Sponsors Program has enabled many businesses to get their applications processed more quickly, a fundamental issue for Australian business. When I announced the expansion of the program in March, there were just over 1,400 businesses with accredited sponsorship. Today, there are around 2,300, an increase of more than 60%. The expansion of the scheme and other operational improvements has led to a significant reduction in average business visa processing times for the vast majority of applicants. The comparison between processing times for temporary skills shortage visas between the last quarter of calendar 2018 and the June quarter of this year is striking. The time taken for a business to have a nomination processed for this group has declined by about 76%, from 31 days to 7 days. The number of processing days for an applicant's substantive visa on the 2-year school program has declined from about 46 days to 33 days, and the processing time for 4-year visa applications has declined from about 37 days to 28 days. These are significant improvements which make a practical difference for Australian businesses. Without compromising on probity or integrity measures, we have materially reduced processing times to the benefit of the Australian economy. Processing efficiency in business visas will remain a key focus of the program. We will also maintain a sharp focus on our international student program, the largest driver of temporary migration to Australia. Let's be clear, international education is extremely good for Australia. It's a $35 billion export industry, which employs more than 200,000 Australians. It's one of our largest export markets, behind only iron ore, coal, and natural gas. To put that $35 billion in perspective, last year our total wheat exports were worth $4 billion, and our total beef exports were worth $8.5 billion. It goes without saying that the integrity of our educational standards is fundamental to our success in this area, and Education Minister Dan Tehan is working to ensure that those high standards are always maintained. The education sector supports high-skill, high-wage jobs, the exact kind of jobs we want to develop. International education must remain a key feature of our immigration system. Now, focus isn't just about the people we seek to attract to Australia. It's also about where they go once they get here. It's a notable fact that our immigration system has historically had a strong view on how many people should come to Australia in a given year, but very little view on where they should go. We know that Sydney and Melbourne have experienced strong population growth in recent years, leading to pressure on infrastructure. And we know that a disproportionate amount of migrants have tended to settle in those two major cities. And we also know that elsewhere in Australia, people are crying out for more skilled immigration. South Australia is an example, as is Tasmania. There are around 60,000 job opportunities in regional Australia where locals are not available to fill the roles. We want to attract migrants to the regions to help those towns to grow. So for the 2019-20 year, we are allocating 23,000 places for regional migration within two new visa categories focused on regional Australia. These visas require people to live and work in regional Australia for 3 years in order to obtain permanent residency. By linking regional living to permanent residency, we will ensure that people commit to the areas outside our main capitals, and we will take population pressure off Sydney and Melbourne. As part of our focused approach, we've also taken other steps to encourage people to migrate to regional Australia. Over the past year, I closed 7 designated area migration agreements, or DAMAs, with locations around Australia. DAMAs are about identifying skills gaps in specific regions and working with those regions to fill those gaps where Australian workers are not available. We've signed DAMAs with the Northern Territory, Great South Coast in Victoria, Cairns, Arana in central west New South Wales, and Kalgoorlie, along with 2 in South Australia. These regional deals will help to fill persistent skills shortages in the areas that need it most. I expect that we will conclude more DAMAs with specific regions in the coming months. As part of our regional focus, we also want to attract more international students to choose areas outside of the capital cities. To this end, we are offering an additional year on the postgraduate study visa to students who live and work in regional Australia. And finally, we've created incentives for working holiday makers to work in regional Australia by providing an additional year on their visa if they commit to an area outside of the big cities. We've also increased the number of places in the Working Holiday Maker program so that more young people on a path to tertiary qualifications can experience Australia and experience Australia for longer if they work in the regions. So our immigration system is sovereign and it is highly focused. But we also must also ensure that we always have a system that is fair. Now, fair in this context should not be confused with the faux fairness narrative that sometimes gets imposed on Australian political debate. Fair doesn't mean spending more money or empowering people who seek to abuse the immigration system. Fair means that our system is consistent and respectful of both people who play by the rules and our nation's values. There are millions of Australians who have migrated to our nation through the legislated migration program. We need to be fair to them by upholding high standards in our system. I've spent most of my life living in multicultural areas. For me, multiculturalism isn't some abstract public policy idea. It's just who we are. It's the story of the countless Australians who have committed to this nation and made it stronger. People who have made great sacrifices and created more opportunities for the next generation of their families. Multicultural Australia has never waited around for government to come up with all the answers. It has just got on with it. Our multicultural communities are characterised by a culture of growth, not of grievance. Growth in freedom, growth in choices, growth in opportunity. Our multicultural society has made us immeasurably stronger. Amidst all of that diversity, we've found a way to forge a common and unique Australian identity. Governments can claim credit for some of that, but at a deeper level, we've found a way to get along and to acknowledge certain things as self-evident. We back people who do the right thing by Australia, regardless of their cultural background, race, or religion. We want to support people who are doing the right thing and striving to overcome hardship. What matters in Australia is your conduct, not where you come from. Our humanitarian program is one of the most generous in the world, and it reflects those values. We're one of only a few countries in the world that specifically supports the resettlement of women at risk of victimisation, harassment, or serious abuse because of their gender. The awful truth is that although women are rarely the perpetrators of ethnic or religious violence, they are almost always its victims. Our Women at Risk program provides a haven in Australia for women who are fleeing some of the world's most unspeakable crimes. This year, I'm increasing the Women at Risk program to 20% of our humanitarian intake, its highest ever level. And I've set a target for 60% of our overall humanitarian program to be filled by women, who in many cases will also be caring for children. In recent years, we've also been able to resettle more than 4,000 Yazidis, mostly women, children and families, who have faced significant trauma, including sexual slavery and physical abuse by ISIS. Because we once again control our humanitarian program, we're able to make more choices about its operation. This year, I'll be placing a new focus on evolving humanitarian issues around the world, such as those we're seeing in parts of Central and South America. It's also fair that we give Australian families the ability to reunite with parents overseas. But we have to do it in a way which is equally fair to Australian taxpayers. On July 1, we introduced a new visa, which will enable parents to come to Australia for a period of up to 5 years, with the possibility of renewal for a further 5 years. We've already seen visas issued to parents from South Africa, Venezuela, India, and several other countries under this important new program. Families are required to underwrite the healthcare and other costs of the parent, ensuring a fair deal not only for the families themselves, but also for the community more generally. Australia, in my view, is the best country in the world. We know it in our hearts, and it just so happens that the facts support our belief. People want to come here because of what we, together, have built. Our commitment to democratic and economic freedom is unquestionably the anchor of our success. But it's also true that, inspired by those freedoms, migrants have added enormously to our strength. Immigration and modern Australia are indivisible. Except for Indigenous Australians, we're all immigrants. All that varies is the time frame. Under the Morrison government, we will run an immigration policy that is sovereign, focused, and fair. Sovereign to ensure that Australia controls its own destiny. Focused to ensure that we make intelligent, mature policy decisions based on our national interests. And fair, so that we honour our values and the Australians who live by them, now and in the future. It is an immense privilege to be Australia's Immigration Minister. Thank you again, Jared, and thank you to the Sydney Institute for having me.
Many thanks to the Minister for a very wide-ranging discussion of his very important portfolio. Some come to questions and discussions, so a lot of people here, so just keep your comments as brief as you can. You mentioned early on, Minister, that when the Coalition came to office, you inherited 50,000 unlawful arrivals in Australia. So obviously this has been a huge job for you and your immediate predecessors to handle this. So how is that working through the system now, the 50,000? I know the children are out of detention, but how is the rest of that being handled?
Thank you, Jared. And you're right in saying it is a very big task. There were 50,000 people who had arrived who were claiming asylum. And the process is to go through those applications and seek to determine the appropriate outcome of their refugee status. And that takes time. Many of those people obviously have very limited documentation, and it can be very difficult to determine the outcome in many of those cases, something that has to be worked through over a number of years. To put it in perspective, a few years ago we had about 30,000 people who were on bridging visas whilst these matters were being assessed. We've continued to work through those matters, and that's now down to about 12,000. So the process continues. We're down to about 12,000 people. The overall cost of managing all of the various issues which arose as a consequence of that period is now well over $17 billion. And a part of that cost is this very significant issue of dealing with all these legacy cases.
Okay, just stay here. There's a question there. Yep.
Hi, Minister. Could you give us a breakdown, perhaps, of where people are coming from now? It's always been of interest, the backgrounds of immigrants, and sure. It's changed over a period of time.
Sure.
But what's the latest count, I mean, in terms of where people are mostly coming from?
Sure. Well, look, the number one source of immigration for Australia at the moment is India. It's also the number one source of our new citizens. Significant numbers of people from India graduating under the Skilled Migration Program. And as you know, the Skilled Migration Program is close to 70% of our annual intake. So India is a large part of the program. Significant numbers of people immigrating, of course, from China under the Skilled Program and other programs and various other nations. UK continues to be a significant source of migrants and so on. So it does evolve over time, but in recent years we've seen strong growth in immigration from India, and that's very welcome.
Question here? Yes.
Minister, you say that a lot of immigrants come here naturally because of our democracy and freedoms. Do you think that those immigrants understand the effort and the labour required to maintain democracy and freedom?
Look, I think, as I said, I think that the PM often says we are the most successful migration nation in the world, and he's absolutely right. Migrants have added enormously to our nation. We have a non-discriminatory program that welcomes people from all corners of the earth. That's absolutely how it should be. And I think on any analysis, if you look over our history, you'd have to conclude that immigration has been very positive. You think of all the huge infrastructure programs that have been built with huge assistance from migrants in the post-war period. You think about the success of our skilled migrants. I mean, our 2018 Australian of the Year herself was is a migrant to Australia. So the success of immigration, I think, is very clear. And I do think that overwhelmingly, migrants do very highly value our skills and very, very highly value our freedoms, because many of the people, as you know, who have immigrated to Australia have overcome systems where they don't have those freedoms, where they don't have that democracy. And in my experience, many of the people who most cherish those freedoms in Australia are migrants. My own electorate is very multicultural, and we have many people who have moved to Australia from all over the world. And I can tell you that there is a great passion for our democracy in those communities.
For those watching on television, listening on the podcast, your electorate in Western Sydney, just briefly describe it.
Sure. So my electorate is the electorate of Banks, which is based in the St George and Bankstown districts of Sydney, and has a very multicultural community of people from all over the world.
There's a question here.
Minister Bill Bowman. We now have the regional permanent visa scheme, where we're going to take approximately 23,000 skilled visas who for 3 years have to live in a regional area.
Yes.
Is that scheme going to require people to work in a particular position for a particular employer, or does it just have to live in a regional area? And if it's only that they have to live and work in a regional area, can we actually enforce it? Do we have a way to verify that they're really living in a regional area?
Sure. So there are two schemes, one of which is linked to a specific employer and a specific role, and one of which is effectively sponsored by the states and territories in those locations. So there's two different scenarios. The key point on this issue of enforcement is this. As you know, when people come to Australia, very, very high on the priority list is the opportunity for permanent residency. Under this scheme, if you do not commit to a regional area for those entire 3 years, and you'll need to substantiate that you have done so at the end of the 3 years, you will not get permanent residency. That is a very, very compelling incentive. And we are very confident there will be very high levels of compliance. We also should note that regional Australia doesn't mean that one has to stay in a particular town for that entire 3 years. It means that you have to commit to regional Australia generally. And regional Australia is broadly defined, so it's effectively all parts of Australia except Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Gold Coast, and Perth. So there's a lot of opportunity to move around regional Australia, but we want people to make that commitment to regional Australia because there's a lot of opportunity there and there are a lot of parts of regional Australia that are really crying out for more skilled migration.
There's a question here.
Minister, are you satisfied that Australia is fully compliant with all international conventions relating to migration? And if so, what steps is the government taking to make sure that other countries comply better with those conventions?
Well, look, we comply with all of our international agreements. I'm not sure if you're referring to a specific convention, and those matters probably go somewhat into foreign affairs, but certainly we absolutely comply with our obligations.
Minister, you mentioned that our target of immigration next year is going to drop to 160 from 190. I thought that the figures had already been well down from the 190 anyway. But is this really the pressure to make that decision? Is that being forced by the lack of adequate infrastructure expenditure in Australia? Because it seems as though that's we're really just putting a band-aid on the problem unless we're going to do something about the appalling situation in our roads and services and facilities.
Well, look, just to take the first part of the question, the number in our migration program is a cap, not a target. So the 160,000 is a cap, which means it's the absolute maximum. We've had a cap of 190,000 in previous years, and as you've noted, those years, particularly in recent years, have come in at less. So what we have done is put an absolute maximum, which is less than the current actuals and materially less than the previous cap. In terms of infrastructure, look, obviously much of that is work that's done together with the states. The federal government has a $100 billion infrastructure pipeline that Ministers McCormack and Tudge are rolling out across the country as part of that overall $100 billion spend. No question that in the past there has been a failure to invest at the state level in infrastructure, and part of the population challenge that Minister Tudge is addressing is the need for infrastructure to be in place to meet our population. And you're right in noting that that hasn't always occurred in the past. So immigration policy is a part of that, but it's part of a broader plan in terms of population and making sure that the infrastructure is there so that people can get from A to B without being overly burdened by congestion.
Thank you. Question here.
Good speech, Minister.
Thank you.
I've got a question that relates to a more forward-looking assessment. As Australia's population ages and we see more and more retirees, we're probably going to see a reduction in the effective workforce that we have within Australia. How will future immigration policy help address that? Because without the tax revenues from companies and from people earning money, and paying taxes, we're going to have a problem in terms of how do we fund a retiring and ageing population. And a good example would be the situation that Japan's currently facing.
No, it's a good question, and immigration is only part of the response here. It's obviously a broader issue that you point to in terms of the ageing of the population. But we focus on skilled immigration because, as I said in the speech, skilled migrants create economic activity, they pay tax, they grow the economy, they often start businesses, and so on. In fact, one in three small businesses in Australia is operated by a migrant, one in three. The skilled migration program also, in most cases, has age limits. So there are rules in place about maximum ages at different levels of the skilled program. And that's basically to acknowledge the fact that if we bring someone here under the skilled program, we want to ensure that they have, frankly, as long a working life ahead of them as possible, because that's good for the country. So the issues around age limits and encouraging young people to be skilled migrants, that's a very real issue and a significant part of our existing policy and will continue to be.
A follow-up question. Has anyone done the calculation between net retirees and net productive workforce as it moves on into the 20s and 30s?
Look, I think that demographic work is always being done, and the role of immigration through the skilled program is to help grow the Australian economy in such a way that we generate that economic activity and those Australian job opportunities that helps to mitigate those issues.
Thanks. I just want to ask you about the influence of your emphasis on the regions, because it seems to me that Sydney is a city of enclaves, and we can nominate various suburbs that are enclaves of people from a particular part of the world. And is it fair to say that when people put in the regions, they're less likely to form enclaves of their own kind and are therefore more likely to absorb our values than people brought up in the city where they can be surrounded by themselves or similar people?
Well, look, as I said before, I mean, my view is that the overwhelming majority of migrants to Australia have absolutely adopted and embraced Australia and its values. And there are many regional examples of that. I was down a few weeks ago down in Wagga, where there's been a significant number of people from the Yazidi community who have settled there in recent years and have been very much embraced by the community in Wagga. And it was terrific to meet with them and to see that practical involvement in local community activities. But I think, you know, that happens in big cities too. So I think that we've done, as a nation, a very good job in coming together. I think it's a very fundamental principle that we welcome people regardless of their background. And it's absolutely the case that there are more opportunities for people to migrate to regional Australia. There are many towns in regional Australia that are really looking for migration. As I noted in the speech, it's interesting that historically migration programs have been focused on the number, but less so on the actual distribution of where people go. And so these policies, and to address that gentleman's point, specifically linking regional living to permanent residency, are a very important part of addressing that and helping to provide more migrants proportionately to regional Australia.
Just before we go to the next question, the Yazidis in Wagga, tell us a bit more about them. I think that's the group that came under the special Syrian intake. So you say they're involving with the community in Wagga. I mean, what's sort of happening down there?
Sure. So there's a whole lot happening. I visited a English program where the large numbers of the Yazidi community are really embracing the opportunity to learn English and star students in this program. Michael McCormack, who's the member, of course, down there, our Deputy Prime Minister, works very closely with community leaders in the Yazidi community who have been involved in lots of things around the town of Wagga and festivals and all sorts of events. All the sorts of things that happen in the mainstream community are happening also in the Yazidi community as they become fully integrated into Australian life. And that's not a unique example. It's just one that is particularly notable, and we can do that more.
Thank you, Minister. Michael Mann. I'm a former Australian ambassador, and my wife's a former immigration officer. We've been terribly frustrated over the years by people who have breached their visa conditions in Australia, but have been able to stay on in Australia by administrative and legal issues and just spreading, and it goes on a long, long, long time. It must be much more frustrating for you. Can we solve that problem?
Well, look, I think...
With a fair outcome and a fair hearing.
Yeah. So I think the first thing to note there, and what you, I think, mainly referring to is what we call onshore protection applications.
Yeah.
And that's when someone comes to Australia and then seeks to apply to say that they are owed humanitarian protection. Now, the fact is that in the last 6 months, we've actually seen a 19% decline in the number of people applying for onshore protection. So various measures that we've taken have been successful. And we'll continue to pursue those measures. We do offer onshore protection as a small component of the overall humanitarian program, but as you say, it's very important that that system is there for genuine applicants. 90% of people who apply for onshore protection are rejected, 90%. And as I said, the overall number of applications is coming down. But there will continue to be an allocation for a small number of people in that program.
We're getting close to the end now, but there's a question in here. And one there.
David, just a question on the global talent initiative kicking off with someone on the ground in Berlin. Is the government providing financial incentives for the potential targets to come to Australia, or is it the sponsoring company on the ground here that's providing the financial incentive for these people to come?
So there's two elements of the Global Talent Program. So the first is the Global Talent Employer Sponsored Program, and that's where a specific company says, we would like to bring this particular highly skilled individual to Australia. And that's the program that I announced last week we're going to make permanent. So there's a trial over the last several months. We're going to make that permanent, and that's going to help particularly startup companies whose roles don't always neatly fit into a template of skilled job opportunities to access those highly talented people so they can help grow their company, which is good for Australian jobs. So that's the first part. The second part is the Global Talent Independent Scheme. Now, we already have the case that significant numbers of people under our skilled immigration program come as independent migrants based on their skill level and meeting certain criteria. This is about focusing on the very high end of that group. And we will be going proactively to that group, encouraging them to come to Australia and making the process very simple for them. So, for instance, things like processing times, things like the ability to work your way through the inevitable forms and so on that one has to fill out. So without compromising in any way on probity or integrity, we will provide as straightforward a process as possible for these very high-end people, and we will be actively encouraging them to come to Australia. Because, you know, as I said before, I've seen with my own eyes this example of where highly skilled people come to Australia, work in a company and say, you know, we should be doing this. And as a result of doing this, we employ 10 Australians. And that's what particularly those very highly skilled migrants can provide, and that's what the Global Talent Program is about.
The second last question here.
Thank you, Minister. Around the world, there are hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people in camps, and some of which have been rotting there for years and years. If I remember correctly, you said there was a special 5,000 category of those sort of people that we bring in. How on earth do you choose 5,000 out of all that sea of people?
Well, the point you make is a very valid one. I mean, the awful reality is the number of people in desperate situations in the world obviously far exceeds the number of places that Australia could provide. Under our humanitarian refugee program, the total program, is 18,750. That 5,000 referred to something that happened some years ago. And we look at the situation in different countries around the world. We assess the gravity of different situations. We do work closely with the UNHCR, who are on the ground in many of these locations, and we set annual priorities. We do publish each year the top 10 countries that were the sources of people under our humanitarian program, and it's something that we assess every year. As I said in the speech, that list of countries shouldn't be static. It should be something that we always assess. And of course, you know, we have seen, you know, evolving issues, for instance, in parts of South America. There are things that we should consider as part of our program too. But you're right in identifying that it's a difficult, it is a difficult area, and we will never be able to, of course, address all of the issues, but we absolutely play our part. We have a program which is one of the most generous in the world.
Finally, just give us a brief account of what a normal day, if there is such a thing as a normal day, is. You've got immigration, citizenship, migrant services and multicultural affairs, so you've got a lot of policy in there, a lot of administration in there. What do you tend to focus more on, or is it just what you can do?
Well, look, it's obviously it's a broad area, and there's a lot of policy. We've touched on significant parts of that tonight. But I would say my key focus is on policy issues. It's so important to get those fundamentals right, and that's why things like the new Global Talent Program is so important. Looking at those rules around the business investment visas to make sure they're working as effectively as they can. And also, I spent quite a bit of time working with migrant and multicultural communities, of which we have many great communities in our nation, many of whom have particular views on immigration or other matters. An important part of my role is working with those communities and listening to their concerns. So, no 2 days are the same, but they're some of the key things.
Thanks. Well, as I commented earlier, David Coleman's a very busy minister, so we're very grateful that he's come here and spoken to us, and ranged across a whole range of issues from policy onto administration, and also, I think, given an important glimpse into what the coalition government's initiatives are in this area, important initiatives, some of them explained or announced tonight. It's one of the most important jobs in the ministry. We're delighted that you come here and tell us about it, and we'll hope you'll come back sometime in the future. But for tonight, thank you and well done.
Thank you, sir.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.